allies, and anybody that wants to learn more about the LGBT plus community. My name is Zanardi, and I'm so glad all your beautiful faces are here. Hi, friends. Welcome to the show today. Our guest is an amazing, talented, jack-of-all-trades individual. Eli Altman is magnificently diverse. They have produced movies, studied law, speak Japanese, and is doing wonderful activist work for marginalized communities. This episode dives a little deep into racial issues, how we can be better humans, and really just more understanding each other. We discuss their identity and coming out as transgender non-binary, which I didn't even understand that terminology at first. I didn't know what that meant. I had an incredibly interesting time with the amazing Eli Altman, but before we get to the show, I want to thank you all for listening, and your support means so much. And if you can just rate the show, give it a review on whichever platform you're listening to, that is a very great help, and I really would appreciate that. All right, guys, gals, non-binary pals, here is Eli Altman. Eli, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So why don't you just introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. Well, my name is Eli. I live and work in Los Angeles, California. I'm non-binary transgender, and I'm a film professional. I work in the entertainment industry.
Awesome. That's so cool. I was reading your IMDb earlier, and it says that you're fluent in Spanish, that you like, or in Japanese, that you studied it like while you were in seventh grade. You studied it at Berkeley.
Yeah, I oh wow. Yes, I started studying Japanese when I was really, really young. And I studied abroad in Japan a couple of times, and once in high school, once in college. We can talk about that too.
Yeah, wow. So do you use it in like are you frequently speaking in Japanese? Do you work with Japanese people or
not as much as I used to? So the business that I run now is half based in the US and half based in China. So I kind of studied the wrong Asian language for my current career at any rate.
Sure.
But I definitely have a lot of friends who speak Japanese. I have friends who did the JET program and lived there and taught English for many years. I have friends from when I was in high school. I have friends from when I was in college. So I use it in casual conversation much more frequently than at work.
Right, right. What inspired you to learn Japanese? I mean, that's kind of just a random language.
Yeah. I was a very easily bored child. I found that I succeeded academically without having to try very hard. And my parents thought that it would be a good idea for me to have something else to do with my time. And my middle school did not offer any language courses at all. So there was a day where they just plopped the UC Berkeley course catalog in front of me and said, pick something. We suggest a language. And I was like, Japanese sounds hard. Let's try that.
So, yeah.
Yeah,
that's exciting.
Japanese.
That's crazy that as a seventh grader learning Japanese at a college, like at
Berkeley,
of all places.
Fortunate to grow up really close to an incredible university, and so I started taking classes there when I was very young, and I ran out of classes to take, so I went to Japan on a full scholarship from the American Embassy in Tokyo.
Oh my gosh.
As part of my high school curriculum, and then it was my second major in college, so I went back and I studied abroad in Nagoya, and I did a language intensive program at a university there.
Wow. you're like so like secretly smart, because you pull out all these things. Every time I talk to you, you're like, oh, I'm a lawyer. Oh, I do this.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I did go to law school.
Or you went to law school. Right, right. Yeah. You have credentials.
I studied intellectual property, negotiation, mediation, that kind of thing, and did not ever practice law. I just went straight into film production after I graduated.
Was that always your passion?
Film?
Yeah.
Yes and no. I grew up in a film family. My mom's an executive at a big film company, and so I was kind of always around it from the time that I was little. And from a, like, community perspective, yeah, absolutely. Storytelling, mm-hmm. incredible. Always super admired the directors, actors, writers that were around me. But I didn't see myself as being that kind of creative. And my mom does finance. So I was like, well, I'm not a director, and I don't want to do finance.
Yeah.
And I'm not an actor. And like, here I am, you know, 20 years later saying, I do all of those things now. So I was wrong, but I wanted to do something like quote unquote practical, right? I wanted to find a way to be part of the film industry that relied on a skill set that I saw as being something that would be lucrative and stable in addition to creative. And so law was sort of the like compromise between the part of me that actually is deeply creative and the part of me that is really operations producery.
Yeah.
And that's how I ended up in production, right? As I went to law school and went, oh my God, this is way too much. I graduated, but I didn't want to practice, right? And so after that, one of my friends got a job producing a film for James Franco and brought me in as an associate producer.
Oh, wow. James Franco's a pretty cool guy, I've heard.
yeah, it was an interesting project for sure.
What movie was that?
It was called Yosemite.
Yosemite, okay.
It was directed by Gabriel de Mestier, and the producer who brought me on was Clara Aronovich. Actually, what was really cool about that project was almost the entire crew, like the senior level crew, was female. Not everybody.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
There were definitely a couple of dudes on the team, but yeah, it was really cool to be in a gender diverse and racially diverse crew, which is relatively unusual in Hollywood even now. Like there's been a lot of progress in that way, but yeah, we still have a lot of room to grow and spaces that we desperately need to put talent of color in, right?
Sure. Like, yeah, right.
People who are really, really amazing and haven't been given opportunities on the basis of their skin color. So yeah, I was excited to be part of that crew. And actually all of the crews that I worked on after that, when I was staffing shows, I made a really sincere effort to have a very, very diverse crew. Most of the time we were entirely female, and every position that I could find a person of color to fill, I did. So that was always something really important to me. As an independent producer, it's harder to do that when you're at a big studio and there are lots of other voices in the room getting to make those kinds of decisions. But
lots of people over you pulling the strings and whispering down your neck.
Right, as opposed to like, I am the producer and the buck stops literally with me.
Yeah.
So I get to hire who I want.
I love that.
Yeah.
Why do you think, this kind of randomly just popped in my head, but why do you think movies like Green Book are praised in Hollywood today when they're really this white savior complex type message?
Man, how deep do you want to go?
We can get as deep as you want.
So I think it's white supremacy, right? And I know a lot of people are going to hear those words come out of my mouth and like have their skin crawl a little bit. And I invite the audience that has that sensation to sit with it and wonder about why that might be. But yeah, I do. I think it's white supremacy. I think for white people, race conversations don't feel safe a lot of the time. And that in order to feel safe, they need to be able to paint themselves into characters that they find, sufficiently relatable to who they would have liked to have been in those moments, right? As opposed to who they maybe are in this moment. I think when we talk about race, it's really important to, like, actually, I'm not even going to use my words. I'm going to find this Angela Davis quote for you.
Sure.
That's a really good one. Let me see if I can pull it up. But yeah, basically the idea is racism is systemic. It's not, if you're looking for a racist, you're not going to be able to fight the whole system, right?
Right. And so Hollywood is trying to address it, but in a roundabout way.
Yeah.
Where they don't want to have the uncomfortable conversation, but they want to have the, look, it's a thing, but we're gonna, you know, butter it up and make it look kind of nice and pretend like we're addressing it.
Yeah, I think it makes the conversation feel safer. And, you know, one of the things that we're seeing with, like, what's going on with police brutality in this country has been going on with police brutality in this country. I want to stress George Floyd was not the first black man murdered by a police officer. We've had 601 Southern Californians killed by police under District Attorney Jackie Lacey's tenure, which has been 7 years, and not a single one of them has been prosecuted. Like, it's every 4 days in Los Angeles that someone is killed by a police officer. So when we're talking about systemic racism, we're actually talking about like something that has been going on for a really long time. And I think, yeah, we do all embody it in one way or another, but that doesn't mean like that I'm a racist or you're a racist. It means that we are swimming in racism all the time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So when we're trying to like fight these fights, part of it from Hollywood's perspective is always going to be the commercial. Like, how do I get butts in seats in a theater so that, you know, my rate card is good when I go down the pipeline of further distribution? Because the way that you make money on a film is not at the box office. The box office is what sets the tone for your conversations with online distributors like Netflix and Hulu. It's what sets the tone of your conversation with airlines. So when you're watching a movie, you know, on the back of the seat in front of you, there's a rate that's associated with that. And that's all based off of how much money a film makes at the box office, which means you need to get people to sit in seats. And if you're going to get white people to talk about race, you have to make them comfortable, or at least historically that's been the case.
Right? So it's the money thing, which is all of the world's problems seem to trace back to money. Or,
yeah, capitalism is gross.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know. Did you warn your guests that I'm kind of a radical?
No, they're here for it.
Good. Okay.
They're going to buckle in.
Awesome. We just dive way into the deep end.
Yeah. Well, that's our mission. Kind of our tagline for the podcast is educate or conversations that move the needle. So
awesome. Yeah.
As deep as we want to go and uncomfortably want to get, we're here for it. So you also are founding this thing called, or are you still looking for that quote?
Yeah, I am. Okay. I want to pull it up, but no, keep talking, because while you're talking, I will think and type at the same time.
Sure. So you're founding a group called The Queer Collective, and I have joined it, full disclosure.
Yeah.
But tell the audience and anyone listening that wants to get, that is thinking of possibly joining or that wants to learn more about it, what is Queer Collective?
Yeah. So Queer Collective, I'm going to start by explaining how we got where we are. I mean, if there's like a one sentence version of it, I have not polished a mission statement. Just everyone, this whole thing has existed for about a month. So.
Yeah.
But basically what it is a group of queer identified activist leaning people who have followings, and the followings are not necessarily huge. Like some people have 10,000 followers. Some people have over 100,000 followers. Some people have a million followers. Mm-hmm. We're not particularly like exclusive in that way.
Yeah.
But the idea is to get people who have platforms in a room together to talk about what it is to be a queer adult at this point in history, and how to be in solidarity with people in our queer family who maybe don't look like us. So like you and I are both white people, but there are lots of members who are not. And we want to make sure that we are elevating those voices and listening to those voices when we make our own content, and just being like really good allies across the board in not only word, but also deed, right? So it's people who are making cool content that has to do with social justice, you know, to varying degrees, and that are all queer. And we wanted to be in a room together initially because Kiara, everybody who knows Kiara, put out a call for creators to make content for Pride, and she got like 600 TikTokers in on this, which was incredible. And she did amazing, amazing work. And I'm super impressed, not only with her, but with like that whole generation of kids who are so media savvy at such a young age. It's incredible. But there were only like 10 of us at the beginning who were over the age of 21. And it didn't feel right for us to come into a space that was being run by youth and say like, hey, we're going to bring our, you know, 10 years of experience in and tell you how to run your movement and your moment. So we all kind of ended up in a little room together on Snapchat, and we were talking about how we could get organized. And because I'm a producer, I was like, I can do you one better. I'm going to make a private space for us to talk. So I set that up and created a bunch of channels and started inviting people. And we're now at about 100 members. Wow. We have an aggregated 7 million followers, which is pretty incredible. And everybody in the room is dope. That's my pitch. If you are a queer content creator and you want to hang out with other queer content creators, come join us.
Yeah. And it's going well. And just seeing it grow and how much how people are involved and how the whole mission is to make the world a better place for people who are suffering from injustices. It's great.
Oh my God. And the people who are involved are so incredible. Like Carson is an illustrator who you've probably seen on TikTok. We had our first, like, we need a logo meeting yesterday, and Carson already had four drafts.
Oh my
Like,
God.
I was like, we should probably have a website. Like Rachel Komasinski, if you follow her, she's already like thrown together a draft of a website. So we're gonna be putting out some cool stuff. I think some things are gonna be more public facing. Like one of the things that we're talking about doing for people who know Eleanor Lewis, El Lily Lou on TikTok, she is going to be doing like an algorithm talk that I think we're gonna open broader than just for the people who are in the collective, but like any creator who wants to understand the algorithm better on TikTok, they'll be able to speak to that in a really proficient way. I mean, like we all kind of have our own suspicions about the way that the algorithm works. These are folks who actually work on the algorithm, not at TikTok, or work on algorithms for their day jobs, and they're going to come in and talk about like how algorithms are built and what we've learned about the way that the TikTok algorithm is based on the way that like people get views and followers and that kind of thing. So we'll do stuff like that. One of the things I'm trying to help people do is monetize. So for folks who are trying to turn this into a profession, I'm helping folks get plugged in with agents and managers and that kind of thing because of my background as a film professional. But like, yeah, everybody's bringing some skill set that's really powerful and incredible and cool. And just the level of enthusiasm that I've seen from everyone is so heartening. It gives me hope for the future, you know?
And at the end of the day, it's important to really push and get queer creators a bigger platform, or to get them involved, to get them connected with agents, whatever they want to do, instead of having just some of your generic straight boy that dances on TikTok, like have him blow up. Like, we want to elevate all of our voices. We want to elevate all these people. So it's an awesome organization. So I really thank you for doing this, because
Oh,
it's
thank
awesome.
you. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about it and for being a member. And like, yeah, your enthusiasm has also been incredible. And I'm super glad to get to be here and to talk to you today.
Thank you.
So.
And so you identify as non-binary trans. What
Yeah.
does that exactly mean? Before we get into that, I want to thank you again for listening and tell you about the terrific company working to save balls, Manscaped. Manscaped is the number one and only men's grooming brand for your below-the-waist parts. That's right. I used to nick and cut myself all the time while trimming the sack down there. I would freak the fuck out, thinking my balls would fall off. They would bleed. I would freak out. But that doesn't happen anymore. I'm having the easiest, most stress-free, and fun shaves with the brand new Lawnmower 3.0. It's a cordless, waterproof trimmer designed just for your nuts and even your ass, if you're into that. It even has a little light to make sure you can see what you're doing down there. So if you're a dude and you have balls, Manscaped will ensure that your family jewels are kept in tip-top shape, offering not only a state-of-the-art razor, but also offering things like ball deodorant and ball toner. You work out, right? You cleanse your face, you do your hair. It sounds like you're taking care of yourself, so why not take care of your balls? You can get 20% off and free shipping. Use code GAYFAM20 for 20% off at manscaped.com. That's right, for listening to this podcast, use code GAYFAM20 to help ensure you have a great set of balls over at manscaped.com. Head on over right now, manscaped.com. All right. Now back to the show. And so you identify as non-binary trans. What
Yeah.
does that exactly mean?
Ah, great question. So, transgender, let's start there. Transgender is anybody who doesn't identify as strictly the gender that they were assigned at birth. So, in our culture, we have two boxes that you get to check. You either check the M or the F. And that is decided not by you, but by a doctor who makes a decision based on what your body looks like when you are born. And there is a lot of deviation. I want to also make sure that we address the fact that transgender and intersex are not the same thing, right? There are people who are biologically intersex from birth, which means that their primary sex characteristics or their hormones do not necessarily fit neatly into those two major categories. So let's start from there. Bodies are all over the spectrum. There's not a neat divide between male bodies and female bodies the way that popular culture would want you to believe, right? There's people all over the spectrum. So we'll start there. And then the other thing that we need to unpack a little bit before we can get further into it is gender identity is separate from biology, right? Gender mm-hmm. identity is about how you think, how you feel, how you behave, the things that you want to do with your life, the way that you want to be perceived, all of that. And so there's identity, and then there's also perception. When other people look at you, what do they see? Do they see a man or a woman, or do they see something else? And most of the time, especially for cis people, they're going to do their damnedest.
We can cuss on here. This isn't TikTok, but
awesome. Okay, so they will do their absolute best to put you into one of those two boxes that they've been taught, and they're going to do that based on a bunch of markers. How long is your hair? Do you have facial hair? What does the fat distribution look like on your body, right? So all of these things that people don't even realize are part of the calculation that they're doing when they look at you to assign you a gender and treat you in accordance with the cultural norms that we assign to that gender. Right. So you are a woman, so I'm going to treat you like a woman, or I think you're a woman, so I'm going to treat you like a woman.
Right.
So that's to kind of give you some of the nebulousness of like, what is gender really?
And that changes over time, right?
Like, it can.
I did a YouTube video on this. I'm not nowhere near as well spoken or informed about this as you, but like I read that, that hunters, men, male hunters would wear certain boots that were they would wear high heels that were like what women would wear today or what we would think of. They wore those for their hunts on their horsebacks and stuff like that. And so I guess just different stereotypes and what can people consider to be male or female does change
across time and across culture, right? So like, I mean, we were talking a little bit about Japan before. The differences in behaviors of Japanese boys and girls is really different from American boys and girls, right? There's a lot more fluidity. Boys can carry purses. Boys can cuddle with one another, and it's not seen as like explicitly gay, right? Because those are the cultural standards that they're judging masculinity and femininity on, which differ dramatically from what we have in the West or even like in other parts of Asia or in Africa, right? Like all cultures have their own set of rules, and those rules are pretty arbitrary, right? Like if you can say, carrying a purse is really feminine, but like boys in Japan carry purses, then does that make them feminine or does that just make them Japanese? Right. In some cultures, pink is really heavily associated with masculinity. In American culture, pink is heavily associated with femininity. So it's arbitrary. It's not static, and it is culturally defined. So let's start from there. And then we can talk about what is transgender. So transgender is you don't identify with some aspect of what you were assigned at birth. So for binary trans people, that usually means I was put into the male box or I was put into the female box and I want to be in the other one, right? I want people to see me as participate. Like, so I was assigned female at birth. So we'll do it from that perspective. I want people to see me as male. I want to have a male experience. I want to grow facial hair. I want to, move in the world as a man. That would be a binary trans identity. Okay. I'm non-binary. So this is like this whole other world. Non-binary means I don't identify with either of those boxes explicitly. So, or rather, I don't identify with either of those boxes exclusively. Right. So some non-binary people are gender fluid, which is a term that I hear conflated with non-binary a lot. Gender fluid is a specific kind of non-binary where your gender isn't static, and sometimes you feel more masculine and sometimes you feel more feminine and sometimes you might feel more third gender, whatever that is to you. So I think for gender fluid people, there's a lot of motion, right? I experience my gender as static and as non-existent. Like when I go to the special place in my heart where gender lives, where like I would expect a binary trans person to be like, oh, I'm a boy, right? Like that, knowing that truth in your soul. When I go and I search deep down in that place, I find nothing. I find void. So I identify more specifically with the term agender, which means I just don't have one.
Right. Okay.
And so that's kind of like, that gives you like the ends of the XY axis, or one of the XY axes in what non-binariness is, right? So if you were to put like male at the top of one, at the top of the Y axis, and female at the end of the X axis, and zero is agender, and like a straight line. Ow, ooh, sorry. I'm like drawing a graph with my hands. Yeah. I can't see it. And I hit my microphone. That's what that horrible sound was. But yeah, so then like the 100 would be gender fluid. To kind of paint a picture for you, I'm in the bottom corner. I'm at like the zero marker. And there are people all over that spectrum. And there are
that non-binary encompasses that whole
all of that
spectrum. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Non-binary is anything other than male or female as your gender identity.
And what are you, so you, your pronouns are they, them. What are common non-binary pronouns? Is that mostly what?
So they, them is kind of the most common, I think, because it's already a word that exists. Some non-binary people would just prefer you use a mix of them. So like if I'm presenting more femme today, use she, her. If I'm using, if I like look like a dude and I've been to the gym and I'm like, you know, wearing my baseball cap, like use he, him. And they will people who are gender fluid will often wear like a little pin that'll say like, these are the pronouns I want you to use. So like, look for that if you're in spaces where you frequently encounter people of diverse gender identities and presentations. Like, we try to give you clues, you know?
Right.
So some people are that way. There are what we call neopronouns too, and there is a whole plethora of those. Some of the more common ones are like zizimzer. Which, you know, you use them just the same as you would he, him, or she, her, but you plug in with a Z instead. I think there's something kind of nice about that because it fits into the like singular plural argument that you hear a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Also, by the way, Shakespeare used singular they to describe one person.
Yeah, you'll get grammar Nazis being like, that's not grammatically correct.
Right, it is, but it is grammatically correct. And like some of the most lauded poets and writers throughout English speaking history certainly have used them. Another thing to know is like there are languages that don't have pronouns. Japanese has them, but you basically don't use them, you elide them. And what's kind of cool about that is like you get to pick your personal pronoun in Japanese. So instead of saying like the most common one is watashi, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're kind of on the femme side, you might say atashi. Mm-hmm. If you're on the mask side, but like not super hardcore, you might say boku. Actually, a lot of lesbians use boku. So you get to kind of pick how you talk about yourself. But when you talk about other people, you either don't say a pronoun or you just say their name, which is like so great for
people. Like, who made this up? Who decided that we're all either male or female? is when most people say they're non-binary, does that generally mean that they're like you, trans non-binary?
Not always. That's also a really good question. So some non-binary people still identify as cis because they don't experience dysphoria. And this is a big conversation that happens in the trans community too, is like, do you need dysphoria to be trans? I think the answer to that question is no. I think that you can be non-binary and that you necessarily then are trans, because trans is all gender identities that are not cis, right? Mm-hmm. Unless you were born in a body that was told it was male and identify that way, or vice versa. That everybody else outside of that is trans. However, there are some arguments to be made that in order for trans people to receive, in order for people who experience dysphoria, experience that disconnect between their mind and body, and who want to make dramatic changes to their bodies, right? Either surgeries or hormones or those kinds of things, that in order for them to receive the medical treatment that they need, to feel like themselves, that there is a barrier to that if dysphoria doesn't have to be treated, right? If non-binary people who don't want to do anything about being non-binary, who don't feel the need to take hormones or feel the need to have surgeries, still get to identify as trans, then they feel that they are threatened in their ability to receive that medical care because that medical care, by and large, is still provided by cis people who don't understand a lot of this, right?
Yeah.
So there's a sort of protectionism that happens, and that's called transmedicalism, saying you are not trans unless you are seeking medical intervention in order to cure your dysphoria, right?
Okay, so I'm kind of understanding that, and what would someone who is non-trans, non-binary, what would that look like?
So that would be someone who's like, yeah, I don't identify, like if you're agender, for example, like I don't identify as male or female. I don't have a gender, but like I'm wearing a female body. I've been enculturated female. I'm living a female life in terms of the way that society treats me. And I'm okay with that. I don't experience discomfort around that. I don't feel the need to make any changes to my body, but I'm not like my gender identity, what's going on in my head is not female. Right.
Gotcha. So they're comfortable presenting the, gender that they were born in, but they prefer to not be called that.
Yeah. Okay. Or yeah, like they'd rather use they them pronouns or maybe even not. Maybe they're just like, I'm non-binary and I'm just going to live this female life because that's what I got. Right.
Yeah.
That's,
right.
That's how I emerged on this plane. So I identify as both non-binary and trans, not only because I think trans encompasses non-binary, but I also want to like leave space for people who are like, I'm not trans, but I am non-binary. Right. Mm-hmm. Like I want to let people who want medical intervention have their own language surrounding that. And I'm not going to like take that from them because I'm not doing anything to intervene. I think that that is a valid way to approach this. But I also take hormones. I do something called microdosing. I take a small amount of testosterone every day, in order to do things like redistribute my fat so that I have like a more masculine jawline. I've always had a deep voice. Like it hasn't gotten that much deeper because of testosterone. I feel like I have access to more of my lower register, but I still kind of talk in the same like pitch that I always have. I didn't have like a really high voice.
No, I'm down here, right?
Like I have always kind of sounded like this. It's just bigger than it used to be. So that's kind of cool.
Sure.
But yeah, it has lots of little effects. I take about a quarter of what would be considered a full masculinization dose. So it is unlikely that I will ever present as like fully male. My goal is to be sufficiently confusing that everyone is attracted to me. That's really what it is.
I love that. You're gonna take over the world.
I just want everyone to think I'm hot, whether you're gay or straight or like think I'm a boy or think I'm a girl. Like just please think I'm attractive. No, kidding. I'm trying to present, I'm trying to get my body to conform to the androgyny that I experience internally, right? I would like my outsides to match my insides a little bit better. And so I use the trans label because I am seeking medical intervention or have already sought out and accomplished medical intervention. I don't want to say anything that is like exclusionary to people who identify as trans and are not doing anything medical. Like you still get to be trans.
Right.
But for my purposes, that's why I use both labels. I am non-binary and I am transitioning. Here we are.
Okay. I know we talked about this briefly on a phone call, but when did you come out as non-binary? It was fairly recent, right?
So I should preface this by saying like I came out as queer when I was like 12. I knew that my attractions were not exclusively heterosexual. And I also at the time and like throughout my youth was not, I knew that label was not quite right. The first thing I came out as was bisexual.
Okay.
And I was like, this isn't encompassing the entirety of what is going on here, but there was no language around it. There was no, like, I think I heard the word genderqueer for the first time when I was like 19. And I didn't hear the word non-binary for like several years after that because it was still an emerging lexicon, right?
Yeah.
And the first person I met who used the word non-binary to describe themselves made like a bunch of light bulbs just go like pop, 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 pop. All these filaments, like,
yeah,
you know, my mind was blowing. So I kind of thought about it for a while. I came out, like the first person I think I came out to was my boss at the time. And I was like 26 or 27, somewhere in there. And I finally came out to my family, like as D, all of the above, a little over a year ago.
Wow. Well, congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
That's a big feat, of course.
Yeah.
And so I want to talk about, because the journey and the process of figuring this out, you always said all these light bulbs went off in your head at around 27.
26 or 27, yeah, somewhere in there.
When you heard someone talk about it for the first time, mm-hmm. What was it like prior to that? Like, were you experiencing dysmorphia? Were you unhappy with the way things felt, or what did it
yeah,
look
well,
like?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been experiencing dysmorphia since birth.
Okay.
Dysphoria is the other
yeah.
thing. Dysmorphia is the form, right? Dysphoria mm-hmm. is the psychological situation.
That's right.
Yeah, so I would not actually, I don't, it's interesting because I'm transitioning. I'm like even weirder than your regular weird. I don't actually really experience dysphoria. Like, I don't look at my body in the mirror and go like, I hate that. I've always been kind of like fine with it. Mm-hmm. It was more, the dysphoria that I experienced was more like intellectual, emotional, social, of just like not wanting to be treated like a girl. And mm-hmm. so I'm trying to bring my body into conformity with the way that I want to be treated. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to solve a physical problem. I'm trying to solve a social and emotional problem.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
but yeah, I mean, I've always felt that. And I think for a long time, it was really tied up in feminism and like patriarchy and looking at the way that women are treated in society and being like, this is not okay.
Yeah,
it's really not okay. And that also is like tied into racial justice and like looking at the way that Black and brown people are treated in our society and going like, that's really not okay. But yeah, for me, it felt more expedient to shed womanhood than to like just try to fight that good fight from within mm-hmm. the system of oppression. Right. Like, I can do both.
Right.
I can both like march in the streets and organize the queer collective and do all of that, and also be like, this is not cute and I'm not participating. Like, I quit. I quit gender. This is my resignation.
For real. We're done with that.
Right. So yeah, I mean, for as long as I have known that I had been given this label of female or this label of girl or this label of woman, for as long as I've known that those things applied to me and that those things meant that I was seen as and treated as less than other people, I have felt discomfort with femininity. When mm-hmm. I looked deeper at that and went harder into it and was like, why is that? It's because I really just don't identify with it, right? Mm-hmm. I don't identify with that particular set of struggles and desires that I think are put on us primarily by patriarchy.
Sure. Yeah. And what did that person say, if you can recall? Was there anything that was making those light bulbs go off that
oh,
you heard?
God, they didn't have to say anything. They just were. They just were like a person that I was at work with. And I was like, oh, this person is like doing the thing that I should have been doing for the last 15 years. Like, right. And just seeing somebody else living their truth was sufficient evidence that I was not living mine.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Seeing someone else living the way that you identify with and then understanding, wait, this isn't how I'm supposed to be.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. So I get a lot of people that ask me, how do I know? How do I figure out if I'm non-binary or gender fluid? What kind of advice would you just give to them point blank?
Yeah, do what feels right. So for me, it got really tied up in like my spiritual path as well. I wasn't raised with any kind of religion. My ethnicity is Jewish. I'm culturally Jewish, but not practicing, except on like high holidays kind of thing. Like, I show up to Passover.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like I went on this road of spiritual self-discovery that involved five consecutive Burning Mans, and kind of like where I landed is in a bespoke Buddhism. Like I've kind of cobbled together my own beliefs and senses of who I am and what I want to do in the world through that, like trying to connect to, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, the universe, a higher power,
like, simulation, whatever. Simulation.
Yeah, like yeah. I'm not picky about terminology at all. But for me, it was like, as I got to know myself better, it was tied up in like, how do I want to be in the world and what do I want to do with this life? And we don't know what comes after, and we don't know anything. And what we know is the present moment. We're here now. We get to make choices. And I want to make choices that align with my highest self. And for me, like, that meant forsaking gender, like, as part of it, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I mean, is there a simple answer to that question? How do I know if I'm non-binary? Like, no, sorry. Right. You got to do work. And I will say, like, if that question is bothering you a lot, there is a likelihood that you are somewhere in the trans end of the spectrum, right? That you're not cis. I don't know a lot of cis people who think about gender every day of their lives. I have thought about gender basically every day of my life. Like, I don't remember a time that I didn't think about it. So if you're thinking about it a lot, there's probably a reason for it. But yeah, I mean, as litmus tests go, that's like a very basic one to start with. It's a journey of self-discovery, just like it is with sexuality, just like it is with anything else that we're doing on this earthly plane.
Right. And non-conforming people have been around for forever, right? Yeah. There's, I mean, I know there's the Indigenous Americans had something called Two-Spirit, right. Mm-hmm. And then ancient Egypt, there was a term for it. So there's a history to it for sure as well.
Oh yeah, we've always been here. I think one of the things that is important to remember is like the victors write the history, right? And both in the context of gender and sexuality and in the context of race and ethnicity, the like one of the hardest things to learn is that we were lied to from childhood about the way things are. Christopher Columbus did not discover America, right? Like, America had been discovered by indigenous people who had lived here for a really long time before. And that's a lie that we've kind of gotten used to hearing. Like, oh, right. Mm-hmm. Thing we were taught as children that we now understand is not true. There are lots and lots and lots of lies like that. And one of those lies is that homosexuality is new or deviant, that gender diversity is new or deviant. They're not. Like, cultures throughout history all over the world have recognized third gender people of varying types. And it is the erasure of those histories that brings us to this moment of going like, wait, I didn't even know that was a thing.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And then ultimately it leads to the ignorance of it, or the people that, because they don't know it's a thing, they don't like it. So.
Right. It's intentional and it's systemic, and it's tied into like capitalism as well. It's tied into, I mean, so one of the first TikToks I made that like made me go, oh, maybe I should make more TikToks, was a video where I was talking about how the gender binary, not gender, but the gender binary, such as it is a lie perpetuated by capitalism, by specifically capitalist patriarchy, but by capitalism in order to control the means of production. So what we do is we say, oh, we need workers to do this thing, and we need zero drag workers. They need to be available all the time. So the way that we're going to do that is we're going to put men into work, and we're going to assign women the duty of taking care of that man so that he can always be available to work, and of reproduction so that there will be more workers in the future, right? We constantly need a new churn of workers. How do we get that? Compulsory heterosexuality. You have to get married and have babies so that those babies can work or support someone who's working. That's
wow. I never thought of it like that.
Yeah.
That's intense.
Michel Foucault, 20th century French philosopher, gay guy. I think he died of AIDS or HIV. He was definitely HIV positive. But yeah, I mean, he's dense and hard to read, but definitely has some like very cool thinking about the way that capitalism and gender and sexuality, more sexuality than gender, are intertwined.
So. What's his name?
Michel Foucault.
Michel Foucault.
Looks like Michael Foucault.
Michael, okay. I'm sure if I Google it, it'll autocorrect and come up.
He was cribbing from somebody else, but where I learned about the panopticon was from him, which is this idea of a prison where it's circular and there's a tower in the middle. And at the beginning, there are guards in that tower. Because it's circular, you can't see anybody who's in the cells on either side of you, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's facing toward that center tower. And at the beginning, the guards are there and they're calling out people for misbehavior, right? Like, oh, hey, don't you rattle your cage. And eventually, the panopticon doesn't need guards because you can just call out, you could put like a random number generator that says like cell 132, stop doing that. And that'll make everybody else think, even though it's just a recording, that, oh, there's someone watching and somebody in cell 132 just got in trouble. Right. And I want to make sure that I don't get in trouble. And so what you create is a self-policing system. So we're using this metaphor of a prison, but really what it is society. Is that we are all constantly policing ourselves on these things that we have been told that we need to police ourselves on, like who we love, how we present, what kind of jobs we have, all of that. But that is actually like something we're doing to ourselves at this point.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you see like there's dads out there that will beat their kids if they want to dress like a Disney princess, if they're a boy or born a boy. It's ridiculous. And it's honestly, once you wake up to the fact that like, it doesn't matter and that we're all human and just let people be how they are, it's so hard seeing other people not have that realization.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been like, if we're going to get really real, it's been one of the things that I've struggled with the most in this moment surrounding George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and for our community, Tony McDade, right? And like the countless other people who have been murdered by police.
Yeah.
Is that like, I see a lot of white folks who are woke enough to understand that there's something going on, but have not yet like crossed that threshold that as gay people, we all have to cross vis-a-vis our own sexuality, right? Mm-hmm. Like we all had to kind of go over the rainbow, right?
Yeah.
I'm seeing a lot of white people who are like on the rainbow, but haven't gone all the way over it yet. Like, but I hear there's a pot of gold on the other side. Like I'm afraid that I'm going to land and it's going to hurt. And like, if you're white and you're listening to this, if you're a white queer person listening to this, like what I would like to offer you is that doing anti-racist work is one of the most relieving experiences I've ever had. It feels so good to scrape off the muck of racism. Mm-hmm. It feels amazing because now you're in solidarity with people, right? Instead of it just being about me and my pain and my experience and my otherness, you're able to talk to folks whose experience doesn't look like yours, but matches it in terms of the way that we have been oppressed, right?
Mm-hmm.
We all, I mean, obviously the way that racism affects people is different from the way that sexism and like homophobia affect people. But to the extent that we are all marginalized, we have that in common. And what we have in common is so much greater than what we don't.
Oh, amen. Yeah, for sure. Did you hear about Brayla Stone?
No.
Is that name? Brayla Stone was a 17-year-old trans black woman that was murdered in Arkansas just a few days ago.
Oh my God.
And the media isn't covering it. Like I made a TikTok on it, but I Googled, you know, her name, her story. I clicked news, like, you know, when you go to the news section of Google, and the only articles covering it are from like, you know, obscure pride or LGBT organizations.
Yep.
It's ridiculous. And the local media that did cover it, like the Little Rock news station, they're dead naming her on behalf of the parents, because the parents requested that they use her dead name.
Right. So, okay. So this is another aspect of it, right? Which is that we're in diaspora. Queer people are typically not born to queer people, which means that like, we all have to come out and find each other in order to be in community with other queer people.
Right.
And so what happens is, yeah, you've got a trans woman born to homophobic cis parents who understand her pain in the context of her race because they share that with her, but they don't understand it in the context of her gender and sexuality. And so like, it is really important. It is really important for white queers to come and like stand in solidarity with the members of our queer family, yeah, of our queer diaspora who are like suffering at the hands of the cis straight people in their lives in the same way that we did, and like stand up with and for them, so that that doesn't happen, so that you don't end up with like an enraging murder of a Black trans woman that results in her getting dead named in the news, right?
Yeah, and dead named at her death, like it's right. The biggest disrespect, like.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a passing to do that. What can white people do? And this is a blanket statement, but I guess more like, yeah, what are you doing to stand with the Black community and to help push the education that's needed to yeah, erase systemic racism, or at least to fight it.
Right.
Yeah.
So the first thing is, you can relax a little bit because you don't have to be in charge.
Yes.
Like, don't lose the urgency or the sense of like discomfort with what's going on. Those are valuable and they are fuel. But really it's like, look to the leadership within the Black community. Like, they have been fighting this fight for literally 400 years. There are texts that are over 100 years old written by Black people at this point, you know, who were like the first generation of freed slaves and who finally got the opportunity to write something down, to learn to read and write and put it on paper. And like, you can go read, you know, if you want to start with the history, go start with like Frederick Douglass. But if you want to get involved in the present moment and you don't need all of that, you know, social proofing, and you're like, oh yeah, I believe that Black leadership has been around and has been doing this. It's great to plug into BLM, but it's even better, I think, to plug into organizations, multiracial organizations, or specific to whatever your race organizations are, to work in solidarity with those movements without creating a burden for Black people to have to then educate you to get you as far as they already are, right? So like, look to them for leadership and what we should be doing. I live in Los Angeles, so a lot of what I'm looking at is what's going on here. I'm part of an organization called White People for Black Lives, which is exactly what it sounds like. And it's all white people in a room together talking about how to dismantle systemic racism, based on like readings and quotations and like mandates provided by the BLM movement. And you can like talk to other white people about race who also care and who are also struggling. Another thing I want to really do is normalize, like, we are all going to screw up. You don't have to be perfect. Perfectionism is part of white supremacy. It's part of patriarchy. Like, it is saying, you know, in order to achieve any kind of like power in society, you have to do it exactly right. And the only people who can do it exactly right are straight white cis men. And so like, all of us suffer from that fear that we're not going to do it right, whatever the it is. So that's the perfectionism. There's also like the imposter syndrome that comes with that. All of these like isms that happen, that's also part of white supremacy. So by showing up in the room and saying, yeah, I'm not going to be perfect, but I'm here to listen, and I'm here to work on my own internal relationship with racism, and I'm here to work on racism in community with other people, it's like, it feels good. It feels amazing. It's like letting go of all of this resistance to the idea that you're in any way a participant because you're afraid of being called a racist or somehow participating in racism. Like, we all participate in racism, regardless of what the color of your skin is. You grew up in a racist society. Racism isn't like, it's not you're a racist, I'm a racist. It's the water we swim in is racism.
Yeah.
And yeah. So it impacts all of us.
And if, yeah, and implicit bias too.
Yeah.
I remember I first learned about that. It was actually the very first episode of this podcast.
Awesome.
This guy, Henry, who is studying psychology and stuff, he's he taught me about implicit bias. And he basically painted it as it's this smog that's fairly invisible that we're all mm-hmm. just breathing.
Yeah.
And we're breathing racism, and whether we know it or not, or whether we like it or not, it's there. Uh-huh. And it's taking form in our society. So.
Right. So like, I want to release you from thinking, if you're listening to this, I want to release you from thinking that you aren't good enough, or that your best efforts aren't going to be good enough, or that messing up at all means that you shouldn't participate. Like, we're all going to mess up. I'm sure I've even messed up in the last half hour, 45 minutes of the talking, right? Like, you're not always going to say it perfectly. You're not always going to do it perfectly. And I think, okay, so here's another one. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about cancel culture.
Yes. Yes. Let's do it.
So I think cancel culture is also white supremacy. I think cancel culture is also homophobia, because, and I think it's like, we get into it in like my early activism, the way that I got into activism was through rape. Mm-hmm. And I think like, that's one of the really easy examples to point to, is like when we call somebody a rapist, and then we say, we're going to ostracize you and we're going to kick you out of the community or whatever, because that's the only thing that we have available, because the criminal justice system does not prosecute rapists. Like, it just doesn't.
Right. Especially if you're white and wealthy and powerful. Mm-hmm.
Right. Which is like, yeah.
With the rapist we're talking about.
You already said it. Yes. Yeah. So when we're talking about that, right, like what happens is that these guys get ostracized, and then they become these like little black hole pits of like condensed rage and despair. And that doesn't help anybody. Mm. That helps literally no one. That doesn't help him. That doesn't help his victim. That doesn't help our society. All it does is it shuts the conversation down, because when it's so egregious that what you're going to do is throw somebody out of the community, you don't want to do that to anybody. Nobody wants to throw their friends out. Right.
Right.
And nobody wants to throw their friends out as a racist. Nobody wants to throw out their colleagues at work for whatever it is they said or did. So when we are looking at cancel culture, what cancel culture is doing is essentially saying the only punishment that we have available against this kind of behavior is the hardest hammer that we have, which is we're gonna pretend you don't exist anymore. We're gonna cancel you. Mm-hmm. When you do that, you shut the conversation down. You stop it from being something where we can say, oh, I made a mistake. I said something wrong. I didn't do this right. And like, here's what my soul searching and thinking has been on that. And like, have I corrected for it? That whole conversation, that like normalizing conversation, falls out the window.
Right.
Because the only option available is, no, you are anathema. You do not belong. Go away. We never want to hear from you again. Well, people don't die when you cancel them.
Right. Okay? And it stunts growth, because it doesn't encourage or allow people to grow.
Precisely.
If you're looking from the outside in, you might say, well, why would I want to grow if I'm just going to get canceled anyway?
Right. So one of the things that I've learned from like being in community with Black activism is there's this thing, if you haven't heard of it before, called call-in culture, as opposed to call-out culture. Mm. Call-in culture says, hey, I care about you enough to do the emotional labor of showing up for you and saying what you said or did in this instance was not okay. And I'm going to help you work through why you said or did it. And I'm going to help you like do that growing. That's calling in. That's saying, mm-hmm. I, as a white person, am taking responsibility for you as a white person who I also think firmly at your core are not a racist, right? But yeah. What you just said or did is kind of racist. Like, you got a little racism in your teeth, you know? Like, if somebody told you you had a little lettuce in your teeth, you'd be like, oh, thanks. So did I get it? Right.
Right. Right.
But instead, people are like, oh, I don't have lettuce in my teeth. I don't have racism in my teeth. Right. It's like, what you do. So as your friend and as someone who cares about you, I'm going to let you know that you've got a little racism in your teeth, and I'm going to help you work through it. And like, when we all do that for one another, that's revolutionary. That's mm-hmm. how we disembody. That's how we disconnect from the racism that we are like have internalized and are living in. And it's lifelong work. It's something yeah. that we're doing every single day. It's not like go really hard, show up at 15 protests, like break yourself, and then don't do anything, because that doesn't help us long term. It's great in the short term because you get counted by the helicopters. But I would so much rather you go to like one or two protests, or don't go to any, and instead show up online, show up for your friends, talk to people. End cancel culture. We can't do this alone. We can only do it in community.
That I love that. That you said that perfectly. I want to say Is there a there's a difference, though, at least in my mind, between canceling someone for rape or sexual assault versus like a racist joke, right? Like, don't the I feel like the appropriate response to, say, like Chris D'Elia, who's been in the news for grooming 16-year-old girls and inviting them over and stuff, like, shouldn't we just shun them and literally cancel them because they're a predator to society, versus someone who might have said a racist joke or did something?
Yeah.
Where in that instance, we should do what you just said.
I mean, I think it's in a case-by-case evaluation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, are we looking at somebody whose behavior is so monstrous and disconnected from, like, the ability to empathize with human beings that, like, they basically need to be put in a room with a team of therapists and, like, spend their entire lives figuring out why they did that?
Right.
Or are we looking at somebody who, generally speaking, is well-meaning and said something stupid? Like, those are different cases. And so this kind of gets back to, like, the banhammer thing, right? Like, if the only tool you have is canceling and you're applying it in every situation, then it gets harder to, like, see the subtleties. And they're not even that subtle. It's very obvious when somebody is, like, grooming children that that's a problem that needs to be dealt with proportionate response. Right. Mm-hmm. And that proportionate response might be a prison sentence. That proportionate response might be, you know, compulsory therapy or something. Mm-hmm. Right. But I mean, also, as we are in this moment of upheaval and of social justice and uprising, right, like, one of the things we are trying to do is dismantle the prison system, because part of the issue is, like, police and prisons have been given responsibility for things that don't belong to them, right? Like,
right.
Mental health does not belong to a police officer. Mental health belongs with mental health professionals. And so if we have people who are, like, specifically working on those kinds of cases, where people have done just absolutely horrific things and that's their whole job, like, great. That's what I want. What I want is the destruction of the culture that allows that person as a symptom to have done that thing, right?
Mm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
You went real hard.
That was deep. That we did go hard. I think that was a very productive conversation.
Yeah, likewise.
Yeah. Where can people find you? Your social.
Oh yeah. So if you're on TikTok, I'm at MixMetaphor, MX.metaphor. I basically don't otherwise exist as, like, an influencer on the internet. Like, if you want to follow me on Instagram, I haven't posted anything, but it's the same username, Mixed Metaphor, just without the dot. And yeah, I don't know.
And then,
Queer Collective, like, anything to do with Queer Collective is going to reach me at some point. So reach out to any of us, I guess.
A new website possibly coming, or a new website
coming soon. Yeah, working on that right now. And yeah, we'll have some events. And yeah, I mean, TikTok's probably the place to find me right now, I would say.
Yeah.
Mixed Metaphor. That's the one.
Do we know what the domain is yet? Have you bought a domain?
So we're kind of going back and forth. It's either going to be thequeercollective.us or thequeercollective.co. The .com was like $2,000 and none of us have money.
So. Yeah, we don't need that. Hey, when I bought Alphabet Mafia, I bought the Alphabet Mafia because I wanted Alphabet Mafia, but that guy was like $3,200. And I was like, fuck you. I'm just going to put the in front of it. And I got it for $14. So.
Right. Precisely. So yeah, we'll have more for y'all very soon. I promise. We're working every day. So.
Awesome. I love it. Well, I appreciate you coming on and taking time to speak with me.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me and for letting me, like, just talk about my truth and what I'm seeing going on in the world. And for everybody listening, I hope that some of this resonated with you, and please feel free to reach out if you want to talk about it more.
Thank you all so much for listening. You are all so beautiful and amazing. Make sure to check us out at www.thealphabetmafia.com. You can read our blogs there. You can support our brand. Get a sticker. Get yourself a sticker. That really helps us. It raises brand awareness. You put it on your water bottle. You put it on your laptop. It becomes more of a common thing seen around town. If you want to be featured on our YouTube show where I answer your DMs and emails regarding, you know, your situation you're in or needing advice, you can email us at info@thealphabetmafia.com. Again, that's info@thealphabetmafia.com. Just put in the headline LGBTQ plus advice, something like that, and I will try and read it and then use it on the show. Of course, if you need serious help, you can visit the trevorproject.org, or you can give them a call at 1-866-488-7386. If you are in need of serious help, please reach out to those people immediately. They will be more than happy to help in a tremendous way. Thank you all for tuning in, and I hope you have a beautiful morning, evening, whatever it is. Good night.